argument is United States against Yonason.
May it please the Court. I'd like to speak today about two issues that we raised in our brief. The first would be Mr. Jonathan's competency, and the second would be his request for Genxact materials. Now, my client represented himself at trial in the district court, and despite ample evidence in the record raising doubts as to Mr. Jonathan's competency to proceed to trial and to represent himself in doing so, the district court did not conduct a deeper inquiry into Mr. Jonathan's competence. A deeper inquiry was warranted here. There was compelling evidence before the court, particularly standby counsel's observations that Mr. Jonathan may have been suffering from delusions and paranoia, that he saw a conspiracy among the district court, the prosecutor, and also standby counsel. That he had scrambled thought processes and irrational thoughts, and that he insisted on these frivolous defenses, his sovereign citizen defenses. And so standby counsel averred all of this before the district court, yet the district court never ordered a competency examination to dig a little deeper and to understand whether Mr. Jonathan was in fact competent to proceed to trial. Now, the district court did conduct a status conference in which it ruled that Mr. Jonathan was competent to proceed. However, I think the error here is the fact that before the court we have standby counsel's observations, and the district court, I don't think, adequately addressed those, the observations and the opinions of standby counsel as to Mr. Jonathan's competence. Instead, the district court just concludes, without tying that conclusion to any factual basis in the record, whether it be to evidence or to its own observations of Mr. Jonathan, it never ties that to its conclusion that he is, in fact, competent to proceed to trial. So I think that is an issue with the district court's ruling in that regard. Now, as the case proceeded and as Mr. Jonathan represented himself at trial, I think there was continuing reasonable cause for the judge to sua sponte order a competency examination. Mr. Jonathan consistently displayed erratic and irrational behavior during the trial. Sometimes the court, even on the record, evidences its misgivings with Mr. Jonathan's ability to represent himself and to whether he really comprehended the seriousness of the charges against him. So I think there was continuing reasonable cause during trial to raise this issue of competency and to dig a little deeper and conduct, order a competency examination by a professional, and hold a subsequent hearing on Mr. Jonathan's competency.
There's no mental health history here. That wasn't part of the factual basis for counsel's motion.
There was no history of mental health, and given the background and life story of Mr. Jonathan, I don't think that's particularly surprising in this case. He was a man who was, his daughter, who was a victim in this case, she had been to a doctor twice in her life. One of those two times was after the arrest of the defendant in this case. And so I think it's not unreasonable to conclude from that Mr. Jonathan would never have sought out mental health treatment, and I don't think that that is a dispositive factor in this case. Certainly it's something that the court could have taken into account, but that was not in evidence.
In hindsight, what better way to defend than for the key witness to say she doesn't remember? It seems to me, maybe, I'm speculating here, I'll admit, that he knew that if she got on the stand and testified that he could cross-examine her to the point where she would disassociate herself some way. Instead, she, after going through everything the night before with the prosecutor, she steps up there and says she doesn't remember, mm-hmm. which is probably the only way he had any way of having anything other than the result he got, with the key witness just refusing to testify against him.
Certainly, and let me address that. I'm talking about
competency here, that's all. I mean, we're just to focus on, is there some rational reason that he knew he's the only guy that could shut her up if she talked?
Yeah, certainly that's what someone could infer from that. And I think, as the government points out, there are these moments where we can try to explain his conduct and say, oh, this is rational behavior. But I think more often than not, the record shows that his behavior was not rational.
I think the record shows that his behavior was not reasonable. I'm not sure it shows that he had any kind of psychotic break or loss of lucidity or episodes of being out of touch with reality or mentally decompensating. It suggests that he took a great many wholly unreasonable positions, and we see that with some regularity as judges. And we generally defer to the district court's ability to recognize a case where there's a true mental illness at work.
And I would agree that the district court is in the best situation to recognize that. But I think here, the district court, if it did observe Mr. Jonathan's conduct and had it said, particularly I'm talking about at the status conference, had it said, I've observed Mr. Jonathan today in court, and his behavior to me, he's answering my questions, he's coherent, everything that he's saying is making sense, he's well-behaved. And so I believe that standby counsel's observations to the contrary don't carry any weight, and my observations support a finding that Mr. Jonathan is competent. I think maybe we have a different case, but that is not what happened here. We can infer that the district court's observation are the reasoning behind its decision, but ultimately it never explained that. And as for Mr. Jonathan's conduct, I think at points we can say it was an unreasonable, and I think especially his frivolous arguments, those on their own are certainly not evidence of incompetence. But I think here we have these frivolous arguments, his insistence on them, combined with a lot of other evidence. At trial, he at times was having deficits in attention. He couldn't pay attention. He was emotional. There's references in the record of Mr. Jonathan making nonverbal gestures to the court and the court telling him to knock it off. I don't like that. There's references to him having a lack of judgment and acting like a child. And I think all of this together suggests that he may not have been competent to proceed, and that may have that rose to the level of a reasonable cause to grant a competency examination. Now, I'd also like to briefly address Mr. Jonathan's Jenks Act request. He requested, filed a motion for Jenks Act material based on the pre-sentence report's citation to a detailed summary given by the daughter at law enforcement interview the night.
When did he first request this material?
He requested, I think it was in October, after a couple months after trial.
Long after trial.
Right.
Well, the function of the Jenks Act is to provide earlier statements for use in cross-examination. If you don't ask for Jenks Act material at trial, I don't see what the point is. To put this differently, how can he have been prejudiced by not revealing it after trial when even after it's revealed he doesn't get another trial? You only have one trial.
Right, and I think he was prejudiced. It's hard to say exactly how he was prejudiced. However, we know he could.
The only conceivable ground for arguing prejudice would be not that this is Jenks material now, that's now water under the bridge, but that it's Brady material and would be a reason for a new trial. But I don't see in your brief any reason to believe that there's any Brady material.
We have not argued that it would be Brady material. However, I guess I would disagree with the fact that he couldn't yet request this Jenks Act material at the time that he did.
I'm not asking whether he could request it or not. Mm-hmm. I'm asking how he can show prejudice from not having it. Since he can't get another trial just because he gets Jenks Act material on his request 2 months after trial, what is his loss from not having it, unless he believes it's Brady material?
Excuse me. I believe that there is some prejudice. If he could use this to impeach both the daughter...
You impeach people in cross-examination at trial.
Correct.
The trial is over. There's not Correct. Going to be another trial.
Well, there could be another trial if these materials, namely the prosecutor's notes, were found to be statements by the court and those had not been provided.
No, there would not be another trial. You get Jenks Act materials if you ask for them at the right time.
Right. And
right? So there's no basis for another trial in the fact that no Jenks material was asked for and therefore none was provided.
And so I think if we look at the record, it's possible that Mr. Johnson did request Jenks Act material at the close of the government's case. And his
It's possible? We have a trial transcript.
Well, so he... I would direct you to his oral motion that he made at the close of the government's case, and he cites to the statute, and it could be construed as a request for Jenks Act material. So it's possible he tried, and I was not present at trial, and so I say possible because the record could be construed in that way. But, I mean, what is clear is it wasn't until this motion that he filed that the district court and the government both interpreted it and were able to respond to it as such. So, assuming that this Jenks Act request was valid and appropriate, there is a presumption in favor of an in-camera inspection of any of these Jenks Act materials. And that did not occur here. Instead, the district court uncritically accepted the government's assertion that the daughter never adopted or approved the prosecutor's notes of that interview. And this court's case law makes clear that the district court was required to make an independent inquiry through an in-camera examination or perhaps through a hearing if it needed extrinsic evidence to make its determination. And so that didn't occur here, and we would submit that that is error and requires reversal for an in-camera inspection. If there are no further questions, I'll satisfied.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, counsel. Mr. Holler.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The district court did not abuse its discretion in finding Mr. Johnson competent or in denying his new trial motion without reviewing the government's notes in camera. The court was not clearly erroneous in any of its factual findings in this case. The question is whether Johnson understood the facts of the case and was capable of defending it. That's the legal standard. It's a low bar. It is not enough to express sovereign citizen beliefs. It is not enough to refuse to cooperate with standby counsel. And the fact that one makes a poor lawyer does not mean that one is mentally incapable of assisting in one's defense. Most people with limited or no legal training make poor federal criminal lawyers. This court has said that in Alden. In James, where the district court did send the defendant for a competency evaluation, the court even suggested that the court should not have done so, that there was nothing in the record. And there's nothing more in the record here than there was in the James case. The district court looked at the motion. First, the magistrate looked at the motion, and then the district court looked at the motion and said, I have your motion. The motions are in the defendant's appendix, and says, what's behind this? If you have something that you can show me in your conversations that suggest paranoia, that suggest delusions, what is it? And essentially what standby counsel says is the defendant won't cooperate with me. The defendant wants to pursue jurisdictional defenses. The defendant wants to pursue sovereign citizen defenses. That's in the transcript of the magistrate's hearings at record 651. And on pages 6 through 7, the magistrate goes through and says, do you understand the case? And the defendant says, yes, I do. I'm charged with obstruction. I'm charged with kidnapping. I'm facing a lot of time in jail. The defendant understands what the charges are against him. And as you pointed out, Judge Mannion, it's hard to see, if one has decided that one's not going to plead guilty, despite the overwhelming evidence in this case, it's hard to see what more rational defenses there are to take than to say, I need to get the primary witness against me out of the picture, and I need to defend on the best thing that I can. We came here willingly, and I'm incorrectly being charged with federal kidnapping because I didn't cross state lines with her unwillingly. She didn't become at all unwilling until we were already here, and if you want to charge me, go charge me over in state court. That's probably about as good a defense as any defense federal defense attorney would have come up with in this case. So it's hard for me to see how the district court's finding in this case can be deemed clear error. We believe that the district court made sufficient findings to suggest that Mr. Johnson was competent in this case, and the district court did not abuse its discretion in that regard.
We have an interesting question in this case about competency to self-represent, which wasn't advanced at the podium but is in the briefs. Do you have a comment on that?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the Godinez case suggests that the standard for competency to self-represent is essentially the same as competency to stand trial. So if the district court did not err in finding that the defendant was competent to stand trial, then I don't think that the district court erred in finding that the defendant was competent to self-represent. Edwards and Berry suggest that the district court, in its discretion, can impose more significant restrictions if the defendant really can't self-represent, but that there's no constitutional requirement that it do so, and I don't think that there's a statutory requirement that it do so either. In this case, the district court did warn the defendant multiple times, if you cross certain lines, you're not going to be allowed to represent yourself anymore, and this defendant is intelligent. He was very good about going right up to the line, and as soon as the district court was about to cut him off, stepping back from that line. And I think that this defendant is fairly competent, perhaps, to represent himself, but he certainly was competent to represent himself. And the district court was there. The district court could observe what was going on. The district court warned the defendant multiple times and suggested, I don't think you're doing a good job. I do think you're better off with standby counsel. But there are Faretta rights on the other side. And district courts, as this court has observed many times in Berry and in other cases, has a delicate balancing act to play in these regards. And for that reason, this court has historically given deference to the district court. That doesn't mean the district court cannot abuse its discretion, but I don't believe that the district court in any way abused its discretion here. This defendant wished to proceed pro se and was permitted to proceed pro se. On the Jenks Act claim, Your Honors, I think, Judge Easterbrook, you're completely correct. I mean, if you read through 18 U.S.C. 3500, that's the procedure. At trial, and in Allen and Herrero and Lopez, that's the procedure that was followed. If the defendant thinks there's material that is not made available, the defendant should examine witnesses on the stand, should make proffers to the court, should say, I think there's something that I'm not being given. And the requirement that the government turn something over in camera is predicated on the statutory requirements of 18 U.S.C. 3500 C and D. So we're not in Jenks land because we're not at trial. And, I mean, the court can read the essentially at trial Rule 29 motion that my opponent cites, but it goes on for pages and pages and pages because the district court does allow the defendant to raise, at that point in time, outside the presence of the jury, every sovereign citizen defense, every jurisdictional defense, every crazy defense he wants to raise. And the fact that he may at one point have cited Jenks Act like he cited 15 other rules, I don't think put the district court on alert that there was some reason to believe that there was some Jenks Act material that was withheld. The district court was very conscientious in this case. This defendant filed hundreds of motions. The district court reviewed them all. The district court dismissed most of them as frivolous because they were. When the district court saw something that might be that needle in a haystack, like this particular motion that did reference something that the district court thought was potentially an issue, the district court ordered the government to respond. But we are no longer in Jenks land. We're no longer in 18 U.S.C. 3500 land. We are post-trial. We are in Rule 29 land, if it's an acquittal motion, or more likely Rule 33 land, motion for a new trial. And under those circumstances, as the case law suggests, this court has said, the defendant has to show some kind of prejudice. The defendant has to show some reason to think that any statement that was excluded, and you know, we've proffered and represented the court what this is. This is attorney notes that were not adopted by the defendant that don't meet any Jenks Act statement. So the only thing that he really could be claiming is that there's some sort of newly discovered evidence out there that could support his claim, and he hasn't proffered anything to suggest that. The statement that is in the summary that is in the pre-sentence report overwhelmingly does nothing other than suggest Mr. Johnson's guilt, like all of the other evidence in this case. It does nothing but suggest Mr. Johnson's guilt, and it does not provide any reason to suggest that there was a new trial. There's nothing in Rule 33, there's nothing in 18 U.S.C. 3500, and there's nothing in any of this court's case law that suggests that the very specific requirement of the Jenks Act that during trial, documents that are questionably statements must be submitted to the court in camera, should in any way be carried over thereafter to any future proceeding, to post-trial motions or to motions to this court or to 2255 or anything else. That's just not the way that the law reads, and it's never the way this court has interpreted it. So we don't believe that the district court interpreted, abused its discretion in either of those respects. We also believe that the district court's holding under Rule 804B6 was correct. If the court has questions about that, I am happy to answer them. But if the court does not, I would like the defendant rest on our brief on that case and simply ask that the judgment here be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Holler. Anything further, Ms. Chow?
Just a few quick points. The government represented that the district court at trial believed and represented that the defendant was competent to proceed. However, at the in the last minutes of trial, the district court actually said on the record, "I still don't think you understand the seriousness of the charges against you," or something to that effect.
I think that in context can be best interpreted as an attitudinal comment rather than a comment on his mental status in terms of, you know, a clinical diagnosis.
I would agree, but I think at the same time, a clinical diagnosis here may have been what was needed to at least ensure not only fairness but the appearance of fairness. So I think that statement could be interpreted in various ways, but for him to have some misgivings and to state it at the end of the case like that, I think speaks volumes. And as to your point, Judge Sykes, about the was Mr. Johnson competent to represent himself at trial? I think this court's decision in Berry and Indiana v. Edwards, the Supreme Court's decision, they do make clear that the Constitution does not require a court to step in and if they find a defendant incompetent to represent himself. The Constitution doesn't require them to step in and appoint counsel for that defendant. However, Berry implies that it would be within the court's discretion to appoint an attorney in that circumstance, and it perhaps would be an abuse of discretion if there is a defendant who really doesn't have the competency to represent himself at trial. It would be an abuse of discretion not to step in and have counsel represent him. And I think that was certainly the evidence I think indicates that Mr. Johnson likely was not competent to stand trial, but if he was, I think the evidence also suggests he was not competent to represent himself in doing so. And one last point on the Jenks Act. I think here, certainly if the district court would have reviewed the prosecutor's notes or any other Jenks Act materials in camera and found that they were witness statements, he would have been required to order a new trial. And I think the prejudice that could have ensued from not having access to these Jenks Act materials, Mr. Johnson could well have benefited from the impeachment of both his daughter's testimony through the law enforcement officers and her inconclusive testimony of her own. There are no further questions. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Gale. We appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and your law firm's willingness as well. And we thank you for your assistance to the court as well as to your client. The case is taken under advisement. The fifth case.